It's time for What's Up with Deputy Leader of the Opposition, Dr. Shane Reti.
Morena, Dr. Reti, how are you?
Morena, e pai ana. Very good, thank you.
Well, that's good to hear. It's been a couple of weeks since we spoke to you and a lot of stuff has happened. We're going to talk about the government's announcements around centralisation of the DHB system and also the establishment of Māori Health Authority. Also talk a bit about what's happening with India at the moment and our Cook Island travel bubble, which has got a date now. So let's start with the health system. We've seen these big announcements from the government that the 20 district health boards are going to be centralised. You've been quite critical of this. What are your major concerns around centralisation of this district health board system that we've currently got?
So the reforms have four arms to them, and just to be clear, one of the arms, the formation of a national public health agency, I think could have some merits, and I'm interested to know how we can help with that. So it's not just critiquing the reforms because they've been put there. There's one of the arms that I think makes sense, actually. We talked about that in October, something similar. So that's a good thing. But I'm afraid removing the DHBs, look, they were not perfect vehicles. I understand that, and I'd contend that no health system is perfect. There were waiting times and other policy decisions that didn't make sense. But I was appointed to DHBs when they were very first created, and the problem the Labor government of the day was trying to solve was that there wasn't enough local input into DHBs. This is back in 2001, so 20 years ago. And so one of the very first things we were tasked with as board members was to do a health needs analysis, to go out and assess in the community, in the environment, what were the most important things for us to attend to. So this was one of the key points for the creation of DHBs. And then, of course, elected board members came on every 3 years as the voice of democracy contributed to health. This then is my concern. If we remove that, we will lose the local voice. We'll lose the local voice in Tairāwhiti, in Taranaki, West Coast, almost certainly. South Canterbury, the only DHB that's actually been in surplus this year, and is clearly doing not a bad job. That local voice will go. And we know that from the experience we had in the New Zealand health system in the late 1990s when the entities were called RHAs, Regional Health Authorities. And for us in Northland, we're in exactly the same cluster that the Northern RHA was, that is Northland DHB, Auckland, Counties Manukau and Waitemata. And what we know with the four regional groupings under these new proposals, that will be one of the groupings. We're back where we were in the 1990s. And all that happened for us was our voice disappeared into the really complex problems of Auckland. Well, Auckland's a really challenging environment, and the needs and wants and the aspirations of Northlanders just disappeared. And this is my concern with centralising all of the DHBs into some Health New Zealand entity in Wellington, and for them to look up to Cape Reinga, for them to look to Broadwood, the Carles, all the remote areas of New Zealand from way down in Wellington, I'm afraid is just not possible.
So this
needs to be a local voice.
This has been the biggest, I guess, concern that has come out around this, is will we lose this local voice, this input from the communities who perhaps are more isolated or who are more rural. That's been a big thing that we've heard people, talking about. But, that doesn't really change the fact that we have seen extremely inequitable ways in which the DHB system has been working across the country. So perhaps maybe a middle ground is needed here. Do you think that we could be seeing some change to the way that the DHB system is currently running that still includes that local voice? What alternatives are there in your mind to this proposed change from the government?
So several parts to that. You're quite right, because if you remember, the initial proposal was to reduce to 8 to 12 and see if the benefits of consolidation and the efficiency benefits could be achieved with a contraction to 8 to 12. That was what the Roche Simpson report was. But in fact, this goes all the way further, a lot further. And in fact, the cabinet document that describes the restructuring talks down that proposition. And so what I'd say then is if the government is committed to centralising the DHBs, then there needs to be a really strong effort as to what the local voice looks like. Now, I'm hearing something about iwi board partnerships, which I presume the standing Māori advisory committees, the government says there's 20 of them, and that they would be beefed up. Okay, that's a good start, but I need a lot more than that. What we could use is that the DHBs had the three standing committees, the Hospital Advisory Committee, DSAC, and another committee, and they were the community voice, if you like. They were advisory to the board, and maybe they could be beefed up and could actually have more direct input into board decision making. But again, it's not local board decision making, it's now decision making centralised in Wellington. And I understand the DHBs will now be regional offices, district offices, I think is their new name. And someone posed to me on the weekend, oh yeah, is it the same team just in different jerseys? I don't know that because the detail isn't there. But that would be the sort of thing, if there is a commitment to centralise this to Wellington, those might be the mechanisms to try very hard to retain a local voice.
Well, let's talk about the establishment of the Māori Health Authority. Now, this has been, I think, by a lot of accounts, a very positive move, but Judith Collins has been very critical of it, and she's been saying that, I think the quote is, there's nothing in being Māori that intrinsically makes anyone more in need in the health system, which people have been pushing back against as saying perhaps that's missing the point. It's not so much about race as about the structural inequalities that are disadvantage Māori and create worse health outcomes. How do you propose, how does the National Party propose we deal with, you know, the very real Māori health crisis in New Zealand, if not to establish this new authority?
Well, then let's talk to the proposals first of all. So absolutely irrefutable, the health inequities for Māori. I need to make that statement very clear, and have spent a career, if not decades, pointing them out. They are there, they are real. We struggled to make progress on them in our hands. This government has struggled as well. So that is clearly one part of the system that needs improvement. Where we disagree, so none of us are in disagreement with that. Where we disagree is the mechanism being put forward to address that. That is a completely separate health system, a Māori health authority with its own governance, with its own funding, and here's the kicker, with a veto on the rest of the national health system. That is too much.
Now, why is that too much? Is that, you know, some people are saying this is titidity in action, this is a true partnership going on here. Why is that a step too far?
Oh, well, then let's call this what it is. It's a treaty response then. Because I'd put to you, if this is a health response, the very first principle actually shouldn't be inequity. The very first principle should be need. Whoever has the greatest need gets the resources. And so if the proposal is, and this is what I'm hearing as well, that this is all about inequity and partnership under the treaty, then call it what it is. It's a treaty response, not a health response.
But perhaps those two things aren't necessarily separate things, though, are they? Because titidity should be forming the basis of this.
Oh, no, it shouldn't. Actually, what should be forming the basis is need. This is exactly the point, health need. If you have the greatest need, if in your moment of urgency you need health resources, then it actually doesn't matter what attributes you have. You need that health resource there and then. This is exactly the point. This is either a treaty response or a health response. And my view is, if it's a health response, then health need should be the first principle in front of inequity.
But I don't want to labour the point, but how do you separate those two things out? Because they are, you know, inextricably linked. You know, we've got this established document, which is our foundational thing. This is supposed to be the thing that the government and all government authorities base decision-making around. You know, if this is a step in that direction, surely that's not a bad thing.
Oh, they're not actually separated out, because if you start with health need as the first principle and make that the key to your decision making, then, you know, when we're talking about Māori health inequity, it turns out for any health metric you want to name, Māori are probably the top of the need queue. And so those resources would be going to Māori anyway, but it's really important it's done on the basis of need first.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in India, because this is another massive health situation that's happening and has a massive relationship with us here in Aotearoa. We're seeing this terrible new wave of COVID over there, which has resulted in the government establishing this new very high-risk COVID categorisation, not just for India. There are other countries that fall under that umbrella as well. I wanted to know, do you think that the government's doing enough at the moment to support New Zealand citizens and residents who are stuck overseas because of this new category? And the probably necessary but very difficult measures that have been put in place to prevent possible spread here in New Zealand?
really tragic, these circumstances in India, both for permanent residents and New Zealand citizens and actually the people of India. Unfortunately, all health systems are burdened, but their health systems become overwhelmed with the number of people being infected. That's really tragic, and I have huge sympathies for them in that, and the long-term consequences this will have both for the system and for the people in India. But to answer your question, we've been calling for a long time, as has Michael Baker, and other epidemiologists, for a risk categorization of returnees, a traffic light system, if you like. And we've said, look, our high-risk countries need a different pathway into New Zealand compared to low-risk. And we've seen that, albeit belatedly. It's hard to understand why so late in the piece the government has talked about separating cohorts. That is, if you arrive on one flight, you've got all of one floor, if you like, or two floors, whatever that may be, of the isolation facility. And if you arrive on another flight, you've got the two floors below and neither the two will mix. Now, we've been calling for that for a long time because it just made sense. And I see belatedly the government has come to that same conclusion. So are they doing enough? Look, there's areas we'd always like to tighten up. Our border response is absolutely critical. We'd also be suggesting that there should be rapid antigen testing when people arrive. That is the 15-minute test that gives you an answer there and then. And so as you hop off the plane in New Zealand, before you have your day 0/1, that is 24 hours later, you have the 15-minute rapid antigen test to get the first indication as to whether you could have become infected from your negative pre-departure test to arriving in New Zealand. Saliva testing must be much more ubiquitous. You know, no one really likes the nasopharyngeal swab, but it's much more likely to get compliance with saliva testing than you are with the nasopharyngeal swab, and that should be rolled out and become ubiquitous as the testing modality.
Well, just before we let you go, I just wanted to briefly get your thoughts on the Cook Island travel bubble. We've seen, you know, our Australian travel bubble seems to be working quite well at the moment, and the management of when cases do arise in Australia seems to be effective so far. Are you confident that we've got enough in place to protect the Cooks and also to, you know, protect ourselves here in the way that the travel bubble has been operating?
So we're really pleased that finally the Cooks has been able to come into a travel bubble. It seems like a long time from a country that has a close relationship with New Zealand and that has had no documented cases. I think with a view to opening travel bubbles, we always need to be sure that it always has those caveats that what we're being told is happening at the border, that is testing and screening, the policies that are in place are actually happening, that the community response is robust and is in place if we do get a community outbreak, and that the vaccination program is on schedule. So any bubble we open needs to have those three caveats. But if what we're being told is correct about those three items, then I'm pleased for the Cooks to be able to have a travel bubble to restart, hopefully, their tourism market and give them some economic return in what are challenging times.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Dr. Reti. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Looking forward to chatting to you in a couple of weeks.
Kia pai tora. Have a great day.
Ka kite anō. See you soon.
That was What's Up with Deputy Leader of the Opposition, Dr. Shane Reti.